The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. The Time Magazine edition from which I'll be reading today is that of May 23/May 30, 2022. It has the usual red border with a narrower white inner border. Time, in large black block capital letters, is superimposed upon a sky blue background, beneath which is a horizon that falls into more icy colors of liquid blue. There's like a center pathway here that does look like a highway of white and blue crystal. It's called the Cold Truth. And we will proceed with the first article under the climate heading, Why We Can't Quit Oil. There's a mottled artistic depiction here of oil, blackish brown puddle with goldish brown margins, none of which are symmetrical. They look like abstract art, beautifully colored blobs. We know where we need to go, now we just need to get there, by Justin Warland. And there's actually a caption to this photograph of a blob of oil. It's called The Swirl of an Oil Slick Following a Spill in Rayong, Thailand in 2013. At the end of the first quarter of 2021, as the CEOs of the three biggest U.S. oil and gas companies presented their firm's earnings, investors fired off a range of questions about how they were addressing climate change. The market had already come to view fossil fuels as old, dirty energy, and after oil prices cratered in 2020, owing largely to the pandemic, investors wanted to know how these companies would adapt. They asked whether carbon capture could be an engine to grow revenue, and how the companies viewed the climate policy landscape. We are committed to providing products to help customers reduce their emissions, said Darren Woods, CEO of ExxonMobil. Across the globe, we're helping economies decarbonize. This year, the conversation was much different. Oil and gas are now hot commodities following the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And on first quarter investor calls in 2022, those same CEOs announced massive profits. As investors dialed in to pepper the CEOs with questions, the topic of climate change hardly came up. Instead, investors focused on dividends and share buybacks, ways the companies can pass along their profits to shareholders. For years, activists and politicians have condemned the industry for its efforts to deny the science of climate change and delay any action to address it. But what really moves the industry, like any big industry, is financial performance. In the years leading up to the COVID-19 pandemic, energy was the worst performing sector in the S&P 500 stock index, a reality that slowly but surely forced leaders to question their business model. Now the financial rejuvenation of the oil and gas industry has created a complicated dynamic for those pushing the sector to align with the realities of climate change. Money talks, and right now there's a lot of money to be made digging up and selling oil and gas. In a complete reversal from 2 years prior, energy is now the best performing sector and the only industry on the S&P 500 index that has seen valuations rise this year. This renewed profitability has already raised alarms for many concerned about the science of climate change. In a 2021 report, the International Energy Agency, IEA, laid out a pathway for the world to meet the targets set in the Paris Agreement, which calls for limiting global temperature rise to less than 2 degrees centigrade relative to pre-industrial levels. To do that, public and private sector leaders need to pour trillions of dollars into clean energy, while also reducing financing for fossil fuels. Oil production needs to fall 75% by 2050. To get there, the world should already be ending investment in new fossil fuel production sites. The scientists tell us that if we want to have a planet that's still livable, emissions need to come to net zero by 2050, says Fatih Birol, head of the IEA. If these things happen, oil demand will go down. These dual exigencies, an industry turning a healthy profit on its core products and the urgent need to decarbonize the global economy, have led activists around the world to ask a variation on the same question. How will the reign of oil and gas end? Another way to put it, in a free market system where profit rules, how do you phase down a product that's making a profit? Decades ago, before climate change entered the vernacular, oil companies studied the science of how burning fossil fuels would warm the planet and realized as early as the 1970s that addressing climate change would threaten their core business. To protect their profits, they hid the evidence and launched public relations campaigns to sow doubt with the public and obstruct appropriate regulation. In Black Gold, Time's new docuseries on the history of ExxonMobil's denial of the science of climate change, viewers witness the oil and gas industry's decades-long effort unfold as the planet warms. Scientists are silenced, and shadowy dark money groups are brought on to help shape the public conversation. The bottom line was profit. It is hard to imagine putting the fate of humanity at such risk in return for more money, former Vice President Al Gore, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for his climate activism, says in the series. The efforts paid dividends. Presidential administrations committed to enacting climate policy, namely those of Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, struggled to get efforts off the ground as industry lobbying dissuaded would-be supporters. Under Republican administrations, the industry enjoyed unparalleled access, with former executives serving in key positions of authority and making government policy. Even President Joe Biden, who campaigned on a promise to be the most climate-forward president yet, took office with climate plans largely centered on incentivizing clean energy rather than penalizing fossil fuels. Denying climate change science and delaying action are more often portrayed by activists as a moral crime. From a human perspective, it is the gravest sin I can imagine, says Christine Arena, a former executive vice president at Edelman, who quit in protest of the company's work with oil and gas trade groups in Black Gold. Unsurprisingly, industry leaders do not view it that way. In a 2019 interview, I asked Shell CEO Ben Van Burden about a campaign accusing his company of knowing about climate change for decades and failing to act. Van Burden acknowledged that, yeah, we knew, and added, everybody knew. He went on to argue that Shell had since publicly acknowledged the science of climate change, but society had failed to act. In other words, the blame should not fall on Shell. In a free market economy, the role of a corporation is to make a profit, and in that context, the company was delivering just as it was supposed to do. Indeed, when the price of oil declined and profits waned in the mid-2010s, thanks to widespread deployment of fracking and horizontal drilling, the industry all of a sudden became vulnerable to pushes for change. Protesters staged die-ins at oil company headquarters. Climate activists used reports about the industry's decades of climate denial to make a moral case. Meanwhile, college students pushed their universities to divest from fossil fuels, winning some victories while pushing public perception to grow more antagonistic toward oil and gas. These efforts made it harder to recruit talent into the industry and left companies increasingly vulnerable to regulation. Still, nothing challenged the industry's attitude toward climate as much as the change in tone from investors. By 2020, according to the Forum for Sustainable and Responsible Investment, some $17 trillion in investment had flowed into so-called ESG investments, short for environmental, social, and governance, and executives felt the pressure to offer a positive narrative about how their companies were approaching climate. In the world of money, everyone lives on bended knee. Brian Thomas, a managing director at Prudential Private Capital, said at an industry conference in March, "The industry is beginning to kind of morph its behavior to reflect the concerns of its investor base, right or wrong." Regardless of climate concerns, investors across the board fretted about the dismal financial performance of oil and gas. The industry was failing to make money and needed to be disrupted. "The basic model is in pieces. It's fallen apart," Tom Sanzillo, director of finance at the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis, told me at the time. "This is an industry in last place." Fossil fuel companies embarked on efforts to change. The approach varied by company and region, but by and large they were piecemeal and insufficient. At an October 2021 hearing, members of the House Oversight Committee asked executives from some of the world's largest oil and gas firms about their plans to address climate change. ExxonMobil CEO Woods cited the company's investment in natural gas as an emission-reducing tool. The CEO of Chevron said his company would try to emit less carbon in its operations. In short, the scale of the industry's changes does not match the science. Mike Summers, head of the American Petroleum Institute, summed it up in a January 2022 address. While offering an unequivocal declaration that his industry needs to address climate change, he made clear the industry would not shrink voluntarily. "We reject efforts to scale back domestic production," he said. "This is about addition, not subtraction." For a brief moment, the Russian invasion of Ukraine seemed to offer an opportunity for the energy industry to change course. Following the initial attacks, proponents of clean energy suggested that the moment created a unique chance for policymakers to nudge the economy off fossil fuels. After all, oil and gas paid for Vladimir Putin's war efforts and left people around the world vulnerable to the economic consequences of higher fuel prices. The European Commission, the EU's executive body, quickly produced a plan to wean the bloc off Russian gas with a dramatic proposal to ramp up the development of clean energy infrastructure. But on the other side of the Atlantic, the policy picture has been less promising. Republicans opposed to climate legislation have used the spike in oil prices to blame the Biden administration's climate initiatives for hurting consumers. And the administration has softened its climate messaging, tempering it with calls for greater oil and gas production in the short term. Still, even without government policy to serve as a nudge, the oil and gas industry could have used the moment to embrace a different course. As prices rose, companies found themselves flush with no strings attached cash that could have been used to finance a true pivot toward green initiatives. But so far, companies have mostly used the money to pay enormous dividends to shareholders and buy back stock, thereby inflating the stock price. ExxonMobil made $5.5 billion in the first quarter of 2022. It plans to spend $30 billion buying back stock in 2023. Chevron made more than $6 billion. It said it would buy back $10 billion by the end of the year. Shell made $9.1 billion. It plans to repurchase $8.5 billion in shares in the first half of the year alone. The dynamic has led advocates, activists, and politicians to rethink their messaging. As consumers pay more for energy, criticizing the industry for its climate failures may not have the same resonance it once did. A recent CBS News poll found that although the majority of Americans remain concerned about climate change, the issue has fallen on the list of priorities. Gas prices, on the other hand, seem destined for center stage as the U.S. approaches congressional midterm elections. And so, the advocates have turned their attention to the enormous profit companies are making. The companies, these advocates say, should cut the price of their product or else face a windfall profit tax that would take that money and return it to American taxpayers. We need an offensive narrative. We're just saying blame Putin, and they're saying blame Biden, says Ro Khanna, a Democratic representative from California, who is chair of the House Oversight Subcommittee on the Environment. That is not enough. We need to be saying blame big oil. On the surface, the pivot to talking about the industry's profit margin may seem like an unfortunate turn away from the urgent reality of pushing these companies to slow fossil fuel production. But it cuts to the core of the challenge the oil and gas industry poses to addressing climate change. Profits drove the industry's climate denial from the beginning. Profits are driving investment decisions today. When oil is truly no longer a good investment, its reign will come to an end. That was written by Justin Warland with reporting by Mariah Espada. Here's a short article entitled Viewpoint. Even if our clinic cannot provide abortions, it won't shut down, by Robin Marty and Leah Torres. Marty is director of operations at West Alabama Women's Center and author of the new handbook for a post-Roe America. Torres is director of patient care and programs at West Alabama Women's Center. Today, as on most weekday mornings, there will be about a dozen women at various points in early pregnancy waiting for their appointments. Some will be there for an aspiration abortion. Others will be waiting to see a nurse for blood work and counseling and to receive large glossy booklets of fetal images that the state requires they have in their possession for at least 48 hours before terminating a pregnancy. The afternoon will be even busier, with as many as 15 patients at a time coming to obtain the first pill of their medication abortions, as even more first days arrive for their time with the nurses, the informed consent materials, and the start of their 48-hour countdown. Our waiting rooms have swollen with patients in recent months as clinics closer to Texas overflow with Texans seeking care. They've pushed Louisiana patients to Mississippi. Mississippi patients to us, as eventually we have become one of the only clinics able to book appointments within a week of their initial call. Soon, if Roe v. Wade is overturned, as a leaked draft of a Supreme Court decision suggests it will be, almost all the rest of the clinics in the South will close as well. While 13 states have trigger bans that will make abortion illegal within weeks or even days of the ruling, others have bans that predate Roe that were never taken off the books. Alabama's makes abortion a jailable offense for both provider and patient. Once the court makes its decision official, any procedure or pill provided afterward could instantly be a crime. Going forward, our practice must revolve around the reality that if decisions are on the court's calendar, we must be prepared for our work to shift from something completely legal to something that can get everyone arrested. It could be as abrupt as the moment between one patient swallowing a pill and the next receiving her water cup. A patient may end up with a legal abortion just by virtue of her number in line, while the rest may be sent home. Or in the most horrifying of possibilities, a person could learn that the right to a legal abortion has disappeared while she lies on the exam table waiting for her procedure to begin. A patient may have followed every rule forced on her by the Alabama legislature, her 48-hour wait, her ultrasound, her multiple visits. She may have scraped together payment, found child care, requested time off from work, even traveled across state lines. All this effort would be wasted if she happened to schedule her abortion on the morning the court announces that a zygote now has more rights than a pregnancy-capable person in the state of Alabama. Our clinic's been planning for this since December, and we will not close our doors once it happens. When abortion is illegal, patients will manage their own care and will need a safe place to go for follow-ups without fear of being turned in to the police. There will be people miscarrying who will be unable to get medical help because doctors will be too scared of being accused of performing illegal abortions. We will fill the gaps that already exist in a state without Medicaid expansion, with the third highest maternal mortality in the U.S., and with a ranking of 47th in child well-being. Bodily autonomy is a human right that supersedes any Supreme Court decision. And while it may take only a moment for abortion to become a crime, we vow to work as long as necessary because we believe that one day it will be legal again. Here are a couple of reviews, both written by Stephanie Zakarek. Review: New Orleans, reborn again, although we will never be quite sure when or if the pandemic will be over. It is still a relief to see the resuscitation of some of our most treasured traditional gatherings. One of those is the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, which returned earlier this spring after a two-year hiatus, and which also finds new life on screen in Frank Marshall and Ryan Suffern's exuberant documentary, Jazz Fest, A New Orleans Story, shot at the 2019 festival, but incorporating archival footage as well. Jazz Fest treks through 50 years of the event's history. This celebration of music and food began as an idea hatched by Newport Jazz Festival founder George Wine, who was interviewed before his death in 2021, though it was brought to life by, among others, a scrappy, music-mad youngster named Quint Davis, who continues to produce the festival today. The interviews are valuable, but it is the performance footage that really breathes. Marshall and Suffern capture the audacious energy of regulars like 81-year-old Irma Thomas with her satin and sawdust phrasing, and relative newcomers like Samantha Fish tearing it up on a cigar box guitar. There's perhaps a bit too much Jimmy Buffett. A little of his scruffy grin goes a long way, but Miami rapper Pitbull's barn burner rendition of Fireball, complete with shimmying go-go dancers and shiny, barely their outfits, more than makes up for it. Another review, the Downton Abbey crew exits the Roaring Twenties with a flourish. There's a photo here of Elizabeth McGovern in tan and Laura Carmichael in green, leaning against a deck rail, highly polished wood, off to France with a steamer trunk or two. By the way, Laura Carmichael is wearing crocheted white gloves. Though the Downton Abbey TV series had legions of fans during its six-season run, you do not have to be one of them to enjoy Downton Abbey, A New Era, the second film to spin off from the show. Set in the waning days of the 1920s, A New Era finds the Crawley family distracted from its typical genteel rich people routine by two enticing prospects. First, a film director, Hugh Dancy, making a movie picture with actual stars, played delightfully by Dominic West and Laura Haddock, wants to use the Crawley estate as a location. Will peppery matriarch Violet, Maggie Smith, allow such an indignity? And then almost simultaneously, Violet learns she has inherited a villa in the south of France from a long-ago lover, and her son Robert and his wife Cora, Hugh Bonneville and Elizabeth McGovern, pack up half the family, along with a whole wardrobe of floaty silks and linens, to check it out. There's intrigue upstairs and down. Will Lady Mary, Michelle Dockery, be loyal to her absentee husband, or succumb to the attentions of a flirty swain? Will head butler Barrow, Robert James Collier, remain true to his calling or embark on the adventure of a lifetime? Director Simon Curtis, Woman in Gold, and writer Julian Fellowes, the creator of the series, answer all those questions with a feathery flourish. If you do not know all the characters, it is easy enough to figure out who's who as the story motors along. And even if you give up on that altogether, there are always the clothes. Oh, the clothes. Kimono jackets and Sonia Delaunay. Worthy combos of tangerine and turquoise. Cloaks adorned with languid silk tassels. Chiffon blouses dotted with discreetly sparkly beads. Because when you're a genteel rich person, you can sparkle whenever you want, provided you do it in good taste. Downton Abbey, A New Era, goes down as easy as a Nice sunset. And another page of reviews. This is the best podcasts of the year so far by Eliana Doctorman. We have 4, 6, 8 here. This is dating. Eavesdrop on blind dates and then listen to the participants talk about how everything from sexuality to attachment style affected the meetup. It is like a reality dating show, but deeper. Run Bambi Run, the true crime series about cop turned model turned accused murderer Lori Bambi Bembenex escape from prison is gripping without being voyeuristic. Things fell apart. How did the culture wars get so heated? Veteran podcaster John Ronson reports on surprising incidents that stoked the fire on issues like textbooks and abortion. Just Like Us, New Yorker writer Claire Malone dives into 2000s tabloid culture, pulling back the curtain on decisions to put Britney and Bennifer on magazine covers. It's a breezy listen. Dead Eyes. In 2001, Tom Hanks fired comedian Connor Ratliff because he had dead eyes. This year, Ratliff and Hanks sat down for a riveting honest and funny discussion about a brutal industry. Partners. Rishikesh Hirway sits with creative partners like Lin-Manuel Miranda and Thomas Kail, and romantic partners like Roxane Gay and Debbie Millman to paint intricate portraits of teamwork. The Trojan Horse Affair, Serial's new podcast, features a compelling duo, two journalists who clash over ethical questions as they investigate the origins of a mysterious letter. Crypto Island. P.J. Vogt, who knows how to captivate an audience, delivers stories from the land of crypto, where acolytes are trying to build crypto-only societies and outbid billionaires for copies of the Constitution. The Brief, The Other Vaccines, by Jeffrey Kluger. Misinformation about COVID-19 shots may have played a role in falling rates of routine childhood vaccinations. There's an arm. There's a photo. It's a full-page photo. It's an arm. It's an upper arm, the left arm. There's a gray shirt folded above it so that we see the skin of the arm. And there is a hand placing a Band-Aid on the arm. And the Band-Aid has cartoon depictions of Tweety Bird. Again, this is by Jeffrey Kluger. Anti-vaccine sentiments have been simmering in the U.S. since at least 1998, when The Lancet, a prestigious medical journal, published and later retracted a fraudulent paper falsely linking vaccines to autism. They have grown stronger in the past 2 years, thanks to disinformation about the COVID-19 vaccines. Though the development of the shots happened at an accelerated pace, they have been rigorously tested and have proved safe and effective. Nevertheless, falsehoods about them, that they contain microchips, that they alter the DNA of recipients, march on. Public health experts feared that those groundless claims would exacerbate mistrust among people who already doubted vaccines, or serve as a gateway into vaccine skepticism among people who previously had no such concerns. Now it appears those fears might have been well placed. In April, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, published a study showing that during the 2020-2021 school year, rates of routine vaccinations among the nation's 3.52 million enrolled kindergartners fell below the 95% level necessary to ensure herd immunity. The average drop from the rates during the 2019-2020 school year was just over 1% for each of three vaccines. But that's enough to allow viruses to gain a foothold in the overall community of kids, many of whom may be unable to be vaccinated for medical reasons. The researchers cited multiple variables that might have contributed to the drop, including skipped well-child visits during the height of the pandemic and the shuttering of schools, most of which require vaccinations for students to attend. But anti-COVID-19 vaccine beliefs most likely played a part, many experts say. I think that segment of the community who is already mistrusting of the medical community has been re-energized for sure, says Dr. Gary Kirkulus, a Phoenix area pediatrician and spokesman for the American Academy of Pediatrics, AAP. We have had this politicization of the COVID-19 vaccine that just leads to more mistrust. So far, the U.S. has been lucky that subpar vaccination rates have not yet triggered a rise in routine childhood illnesses. We have not seen outbreaks, and that's probably representative of the fact that families were staying home during the pandemic, says Dr. Georgina Peacock, acting director of the CDC's Immunization Services, at a press briefing about the findings. But now that most kids are back in classrooms, experts worry epidemics like the national 2019 measles outbreak are increasingly likely. The recent CDC study looked at the change in childhood vaccination rates from 2019-2020 to 2020-2021 for three routine shots, measles, mumps, and rubella, MMR, for which the rates fell from 95.2% to 93.9%. Diphtheria, tetanus, and acellular pertussis, DTaP, which fell from 94.9% to 93.6%, and varicella, or chickenpox, which fell from 94.8% to 93.6%. Those seemingly small drops are troubling, especially when it comes to measles, which is so transmissible that even a point below the 95% herd immunity rate is enough to get the disease spreading among the unvaccinated. Measles is an incredibly contagious disease, which carries a serious risk of lifetime injury, says Dr. Gerald Harmon, president of the American Medical Association, AMA. Troubling as the national vaccine numbers are, they're far worse in some states. Maryland saw its vaccination rate plummet from an average of 95% for all three vaccines in the 2019-2020 school year to 87.6, 89.7, and 87.3, respectively, for the MMR, DTaP, and varicella vaccines the following year. Wisconsin saw a 5 percentage point drop to about 87.2% for all three shots. Since the CDC last tallied vaccination rates in 2021, schools have reopened with mandates for the shots in place, and visits to pediatricians have increased. Those factors could mean vaccination numbers will recover, but the AAP noted earlier this year, routine immunization rates had not quickly rebounded. Harmon and Kirkelis are not alone in worrying the damage done by misinformation regarding COVID-19 vaccines could have a lasting impact on the uptake of other vaccines, says Francesco Pieri, a postdoctoral student at the Polytechnic University of Milan and lead author of an April study in Nature Scientific Reports that correlated COVID-19 vaccine misinformation on Twitter and negative attitudes in surveys about the shots. You can assume some spillover effect. The activity around this kind of malicious content has increased, leading to an increase in the prevalence of misinformation of vaccines in general. Harmon, the AMA president and a former major general in the Air Force Reserve and the Air National Guard, says the most effective antidote for misinformation is more information, the genuine scientific variety. One of the things I learned in the military was that the way to overcome resistance is to maintain overwhelming competence, he says. I take these vaccine-hesitant individuals and try to answer their questions to stay on the side of the science. From The View, The Opportunities in Global Crisis by Ian Bremmer. Where is the peace the United Nations was created to guarantee? That is the pointed question Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky asked the UN Security Council during a video speech April 5 in response to Russia's war on his country. Where is the security that the Security Council must guarantee? He asked. The urgency of his question needs no explanation. Vladimir Putin has decided Ukraine belongs to Russia, and there are no boundaries, treaties, or warnings that will prevent him from waging war to make it so. At this point, why should Ukraine's president or anyone else have much confidence that the international community will stop this war? More broadly, loss of faith in governing authorities is the defining story of our era. the U.S., the only nation that can project military power into every region of the world, has become its most politically dysfunctional major power. A third of Americans say Joe Biden is not a legitimately elected president. Europeans have lost faith, too. In 2016, Britain voted its way out of the EU, and anti-establishment, xenophobic parties of the far right shifted the politics inside many European states. In fact, the entire international system is increasingly in question. China has advanced from impoverished to powerhouse over four decades and increasingly rejects the right of Western-led institutions to make and enforce international rules. Strongmen have emerged in Russia, India, Turkey, and even EU members, Hungary and Poland, to challenge principles of freedom of the press, democratic checks and balances, and minority rights. Few in any country have faith the UN can do much more than help care for and feed the refugees fleeing conflicts no one can resolve. There's a lot to be said for the idea that crises create opportunities that must not be wasted. It is true our world has faced a stream of shocks in recent years: the 2008 global financial crisis, the Arab Spring, the 2015-2016 tidal wave of migrants into Europe, Brexit, the rise of angry populists in Europe and America, and then the worst pandemic in 100 years. None of these events has created a new sense of unity and purpose. Now, Russia has invaded Ukraine. War is killing civilians by the thousands. More than 5 million refugees have headed west in more than 2 months of fighting. NATO and Russia have moved to high alert. Fuel and food prices around the world are surging. It is no one's fault the system is failing. Order and disorder are cyclical forces. The UN and institutions like the World Bank and IMF were built atop the ashes of a war that ended 77 years ago. That's why Germany and Japan, wealthy and dynamic free market democracies committed to multilateralism and the rule of law, had no seats at the table for Zelensky's speech to the Security Council, and why Russia did. The international system is broken. To fix it, the world needs a crisis. It was the crisis of World War II that created institutions and alliances that helped keep the peace and invest in global development for decades after. Putin's war on Ukraine has created the biggest geopolitical emergency since the Cold War's end. The Russian government has even threatened the use of nuclear weapons and warned of World War III. Can this crisis bolster dying institutions and create new ones? Start with NATO. Since the Soviet collapse 3 decades ago, NATO has faced tough questions about its purpose. During his presidency, Donald Trump sometimes talked down NATO's value for U.S. national security, and some of his former aides say he wanted to remove the U.S. from the alliance. In 2019, France's President Emmanuel Macron warned of the brain death of NATO. Now, he says, Putin's invasion has delivered an electric shock and strategic clarification for NATO. Rather than weakening the alliance with a show of force and resolve in Ukraine, Putin looks to have persuaded Finland and Sweden to join it. The shift in Germany is another big part of this story. The economic engine of Europe, with a government that has long tried to manage relations with Russia by cultivating cooperation through trade, has sharply changed its strategic direction in recent weeks. 3 days after the Russian invasion, Chancellor Olaf Scholz announced during a historic speech to Parliament that Germany would send weapons to Ukraine, impose genuinely tough sanctions on Russia, and more than double German defense spending. His government announced in April it would stop importing Russian oil by the end of this year. The EU also has a renewed sense of mission, scorned by Britain and chastised by populists within many member countries. The EU has been given new energy by the war. The governments of Hungary and Poland have openly rebelled against its rules in recent years, but Russia's invasion has forced Hungary's Viktor Orban to curb his pro-Putin enthusiasm and presents Poland a chance to play European hero by accepting nearly 3 million Ukrainian refugees. If these developments were not striking enough, consider Putin has even given America's Democrats and Republicans a sense of political unity that was best illustrated in March by a 424-8 vote in the House of Representatives to suspend normal trade relations with Russia and its ally, Belarus. Putin has achieved the nearly unimaginable in U.S. politics. He's persuaded many Americans to hate him more than they hate Americans of the opposite party. We must remain realistic. The U.S., Europe, and the institutions that strengthen their partnership will face major tests in coming months and years. The U.S. is headed for yet another bitter election season ahead of midterms in November. And Americans and Europeans know that noted NATO skeptic Donald Trump may well become the Republican nominee in 2024. In Europe, the fallout from a likely prolonged military stalemate in Ukraine might change the political temperature. And though China won't jeopardize its economic future by entering a long-term struggle with top trade partners, Europe and America, just to help its ally Russia, the longer-term challenges it will pose for Western values and interests is much bigger than anything Putin is likely to concoct. President Biden's calls for unity among democracies will antagonize both China and Russia. In short, the Ukraine crisis has boosted some Western institutions that can strengthen democracy, rule of law, and human rights at the expense of authoritarians, at least the one who works in the Kremlin, but it will not resolve the larger crisis of confidence to solve common problems. For that, we need something bigger. There are other crises already unfolding that will offer real opportunities to boost international cooperation. If we can learn from the mistakes of the recent past, U.S. leadership will remain limited by the bitter partisan infighting that makes the U.S. so dysfunctional. And mistrust will limit how the U.S. and China can work together. But if they can form pragmatic partnerships in critical areas, there are others that can play vital roles in boosting global cooperation. The EU in particular has shown that alliances of like-minded countries can still offer big solutions to big problems in their common interest. There are also roles for the private sector, the international scientific community, and ordinary citizens in boosting cooperation. Even as public health professionals and political leaders continue to wrestle with emerging variants of the virus that causes COVID-19, we might not have as much time as we think before the next pandemic strikes. Scientists have discovered dozens of lethal new pathogens in the past half century that leaped from animals to humans. And the pace of new discoveries is rising because wild animals are more frequently coming into direct contact as people encroach on animal habitats. Unsanitary factory farming also creates greater risks of new viruses. In fact, though SARS-CoV-2, particularly in its Omicron variant, has proved highly infectious, it is far from the deadliest virus we faced just in the past 20 years. Given how much we do not know about the mutation of coronaviruses, it would be foolish to assume the next strain cannot be both more transmissible and more deadly. This pandemic has created the biggest, truly global crisis of our lives, and there were real breakthroughs in multinational cooperation. Scientists shared ideas and information. International cooperation on COVID-19 included the beginnings of coordination on research and a global supply chain to distribute the vaccine. Central bankers took complementary, if not coordinated, action to boost sagging economies. International lenders offered emergency help, and vaccines were developed at unprecedented speed via joint ventures. Without the COVAX project, for example, the problems of vaccine hoarding and inequality between rich and poor nations would have been even worse than they are. The willingness of some countries to export excess supplies of vaccines, as the U.S. did for neighbors Mexico and Canada, and the U.S., Japan, India, and Australia did for other countries, created a blueprint for shared sacrifice at a time of serious political and economic stress for all these countries. But political leaders almost everywhere too often blamed and shamed scapegoats instead of rising to meet the moment in the face of invisible enemies that do not care about boundaries. The COVID-19 pandemic by itself was not frightening enough to make us build a new system of global public health cooperation. Few leaders recognized COVID-19 was a global threat that could never be effectively addressed without a global solution. In that sense, the pandemic was too small a crisis to force the kind of collaboration we needed. When the next deadly virus emerges, will we be better prepared? Stopping now to mention a captioned photograph. Blue sky in the background, green fields in the foreground, some kind of a belching smoke plant in the middle ground. So we have blue, bland concrete, white smoke, and green. But in the very front, we see just the top of a windmill. It's a three-pronged windmill in white with red tips on the end, probably to help warn aircraft. And the caption reads, cooling towers at the Niederaußem coal-fueled power station in Germany. That's what's in the middle ground as the country starts to cut its reliance on Russian coal with the wind tower or windmill. I'm going to start abridging this article now for time purposes. Climate change is the crisis that should give us the most hope. It is the emergency most likely to force world leaders to share more information, costs, and responsibilities because it threatens disasters that can destroy the lives of hundreds of millions of people with impacts felt in every region of the world. Here, as in other areas, mutual suspicion will limit U.S. leadership and U.S.-China cooperation. But there are other actors that can lead. Europe has already made genuinely historic progress. The so-called European Green Deal has boosted Europe as a leader on climate by committing unprecedented amounts of money toward the net zero carbon emissions goal. By making climate spending a central pillar of its most recent budgets and COVID-19 economic relief plans, the European Commission has boosted its own power to raise future funds for pandemic relief and climate change from reluctant member states. Only those that comply with EU standards on emissions and other climate-relevant policies can expect to get generous support for COVID recovery. It is also possible Russia's war in Ukraine and the need it creates to relieve European reliance on Russia for oil and gas will spur large-scale investment in green technologies. But progress is hardly limited to Europe. In fact, on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, 195 countries signed on to a document that accepts the climate crisis as man-made. There's now a crucial global consensus on how much and how quickly the planet is warming, on which parts of the world have been affected most, and on the scale and likelihood of long-range scenarios. The governments of the world's biggest polluters, including the U.S. and China, have committed themselves to cutting carbon emissions to net zero. Some of the world's biggest companies have offered public commitments of their own. In short, climate change has presented an immediate, potentially crippling global problem that has forced many governments, the private sector, and civil society organizations to work together. But there are big unanswered questions. A certain degree of warming has already become inevitable, and governments and private sector leaders need to accept and spend more on climate adaptation strategies. Our decision makers and influencers don't have to like one another, much less agree on a single set of political and economic values. They do not need to solve every problem. But never has it been more obvious that political leaders, the private sector, and citizens of all countries had better cooperate toward goals that we cannot achieve alone. History shows it's both necessary and possible. Ian Bremmer wrote this article, which was abridged, and it's adapted from Bremmer's new book, The Power of Crisis: How Three Threats and Our Response Will Change the World, published by Simon & Schuster. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.